Welcome to the 2017 Bay Area Book Festival. This is Sherilyn Parsons, founder and director of the festival. Enjoy the conversation.
Welcome to the Bay Area Book Festival. This panel is called Imagining the Other, which you can tell because you have a giant screen that we are behind. I would like you to turn off your cell phones for the next hour and 15 minutes. Because what could be more important than us? Our other speakers are Randy Henderson and Erica Lewis. I'm Ellen Klages, and I will be moderating. Would you like me to introduce you, or would you like to introduce yourself?
Whatever you think is
best. I'm going to read what your publisher said about you.
How
so
long is it?
Here.
I can truncate here. That.
Do the high points.
Oh, Lord. Yeah, that's a full paragraph there. That would keep us here all day. My name is Erica Lewis. I worked for 15 years in television. And now for the last, I guess 5 years or so, have been solely writing novels and comics. Specifically genre, generally YA, some YA crossover for adult. Yeah, I think that's all the high points.
And Randy.
Hi, Randy Henderson, long-time writer, first-time fan. No, I don't. I currently have a humorous urban fantasy series out with Tor, the Fin Fantasy series, and I won grand prize in Writers of the Future, and I went to Clarion West. I think Yoo-hoo. Those are probably the highlights of my illustrious writing career.
And I'm Ellen Klages. I have two historical novels for kids called The Green Glass Sea and White Sands Red Menace. And I have two books out this year, one from Tor.com. It's a novella called Passing Strange, and it's queer San Francisco history, noir, pulp, romance, magic, you know, that one of those. And a new short story collection out from Tachyon Press, which is a local San Francisco press, called Wicked Wonders. That is everything short that I've written in the last 10 years. So I'm going to start out asking the audience a question, two questions actually. How many of you have a friend that you think is a little strange?
A lot strange?
Okay, and the second question is, how many of you have a friend that thinks you're a little strange? Now, the interesting thing about that question is that no matter where I ask it, no matter what age group, no matter how big the audience, every time, every hand in the room goes up. And that is because the secret of being human is that we're all a little strange. And everybody thinks that somehow being strange is something that keeps us apart. And my theory is that this is what we all have in common. And that this is why we like science fiction and fantasy, because every person in the room thinks everybody else got the manual. And that they are the only person that didn't. And that kind of is the definition of the other. So imagining the other is, I think, human nature. So I'm going to start out with why you think you're on this panel.
I honestly don't know. I try to speak to writing the other, and I try to, you know, advocate diversity in fiction. My Writers of the Future acceptance speech was like this 12-minute long thing on why diversity is important in fiction, and it was a great audience to speak that to. But anyway, my books have, I try to be inclusive, I try to and diverse, and I guess that's why I think they kind of pick these at random. I mean, not to disparage the Bay Area, but I think they kind of pick them a little bit at random and to some
don't
extent.
Stare at Invisible Boy. Yeah. It makes him self-conscious. All right.
And that was a very rambly answer because you caught me off guard there. I don't know.
You'll get better.
I feel unqualified to speak on the topic.
I think that the reason I'm here is, twofold. One, almost all of my protagonists are others. They tend to be the ones who always feel a step out of their group. They're never included in anything. They're sort of the fish out of water. Always feel like they don't belong. And I think some of that comes from the way we all felt when, you know, everybody takes different things when they're growing up. And when you were a nerd in my world, it wasn't easy to be a nerd. And so I think coming from that background, it tends to bleed into the characters that I like to write. And Ethan in particular in Game of Shadows sees ghosts but can't talk about them, so he's completely ostracized and looks like a whack job all the time, and he is, people are always making fun of him. And so from there, I feel like, you know, you watch a lot of people around you, you take pieces of different people who are different, and those characteristics, you infuse them into your characters, not just your own. So maybe that's why I'm here.
Okay, we're talking about the other. What is the opposite of the other?
Well, I think the person who's the opposite of the other isn't necessarily, they wouldn't define themselves as the opposite of the other. Because if you looked like the quintessential, you know, everybody in here watch Riverdale. You know, Archie, the perfect guy, the football player, he's got everything, the perfect hair, the perfect face, all the girls. But he wouldn't define himself as the perfect everything and the perfect one who always fits in. He would probably find his own reasons for saying he's the other. So I guess the opposite, I don't know. Somebody who would think they're perfect. I don't want to toss out any names and get into politics here.
Other doesn't
necessarily imply imperfection. It just implies separateness. But now I'm wondering, is there really an opposite to the other?
It's contextual in the sense of, I mean, in the context of this conversation, or the topic anyway, the other is fantastical. But in a general writing the other sense, you know, there are certain dominant paradigms that have been sort of perpetuated predominantly in our fiction and media. And so when people talk about writing the other, they generally mean other than those dominant paradigms.
So but we're talking about not cis white male.
Exactly. But in the larger context, the other is, you know, you can be, you know, a gay African American woman, and there are other to you. So it's all subjective. You know, it's contextual. What is the other to me? And I think the value is in being able to read whatever your you-ness is. My meanness, not meanness, but my I-ness. my I-ness is, you know, being able to read fiction that exposes me to other perspectives, other realities, other experiences. That's the value and the importance of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that having the one nice thing about fantasy is you're creating this world that, and a lot of these mythical races or magical people that you're putting into it, it's great because you can, you know, there are categorical definitions that we've all come up with in our nomenclature, and then you get to come up with something totally different. So whether someone's, you know, gay in a community that we're talking about in Terra, that there's no stigma there, you know? I mean, it's a different kind of a thing, and you can kind of define it the way it is you want. And so if you're, for me, when I'm thinking about the other, if I'm thinking about the other characters, or if I'm thinking about, you know, who's populating the world around them, I you know, it's making sure that there's something for everyone. But quite frankly, some of my characters are blue, and some, you know, they're all there is no definition of other because they're all different, I guess.
Actually, I just looked up the definition of other.
Yeah,
there is one.
There is? Really?
Well, yeah, I have a dictionary. Because it's the future, and my phone is many things. So the Oxford English Dictionary says, other is used to refer to a person or thing that is different or distinct from the one already mentioned or known about. Okay, one already mentioned means as soon as you mention a character,
exactly,
all of the other characters are by definition other.
Right. Right.
Or the alternate of two, or additional, or yeah, okay. or in British, to use euphemistically to refer to sexual intercourse. I've never heard of that one.
I haven't either.
The other.
And therefore, writing the other becomes a completely different panel. But I mean, so in science fiction and fantasy, we can talk about aliens and dragons and people with magic and people who are, let's define the other as the non-ordinary, just for now.
In the fantastical context.
Necessarily in a fantastical context, but okay. I mean, in your context, it's fantastical.
I just meant in the sense of we want to be careful not to say, you know, because what is ordinary? And if you say ordinary, then anyway, never mind.
Yes.
I was trying to be.
Well, and in a fantastical world, everyone is kind of, well, I don't know, hopefully not ordinary or human perfect, unless that's the lead into the story. I mean, there's always somebody that is. And then as you're building out the different characters, their differences are what make them interesting.
Well, I know on Twitter for the last week, you've been talking about aliens and dragons and...
I'm trying to remember what I was talking about.
You were saying, I'm going to be on a panel. We're talking about the other, aliens and dragons.
Yeah. And okay.
So why don't you riff on that?
On aliens and dragons?
Or why you tweeted that as what you thought the panel was going to be about.
Well, I guess what I was thinking about was the idea of taking fantastical worlds and fantastical things, whether they're aliens or whether they're magical or they're both in the same exact space, and how to take, you know, my fun thing is real world problems and sticking them into a fantastical setting. So when I see the word creating empathy, that was in the category topic, you know, regardless of whether you're blue or purple or Spitfire, and you still potentially fall in love, and whether you're falling in love with the same sex or the opposite sex in your culture, those real problems that we all have every day and struggle with are things that, to me, connect me with material more. So I don't care that it's amazing that somebody's a vampire and wants to suck everyone's blood, but what's really cool is when they fall in love with the innocent girl at school and, you know, she's all paranoid and then wants to become one of them. I mean, those are the things that we all went through. And that, to me, you know, all right, we all wanted to fall in love with the sexy vampire and get connected, you know, but we didn't, because there weren't any, actually, that I could find in my high school. But
I forgot about those days.
Yeah, right? But I think that at the end of the day, in my mind with the panel, which was interesting to me about the subject heading was just that. And, you know, like for Ethan, he sees ghosts, but he's got this incredibly overprotective mom who I'm sure my kids can all feel very sorry for him, because I'm probably very much the same way. But she's like an extreme case of that, you know, or there's other characters where there's a female character who's his counterpart who really wants to be in the military in Terra, and she's not allowed because she's a woman. Something that I think there are a lot of things that women in our culture still can't do to this day. And so for her, it's about battling those and breaking down those walls. And I think that, for me, is what's interesting about the world of fantasy. You can still take all these incredible real-world problems and address them, but in a unique and different way, which has nothing to do with the word other.
Yeah, and I think that kind of comes in, like, sort of different levels in my mind. Like there's the very human things that are relatable that you can place on other characters, whether it be they elves or aliens or whatever, the desire to fit in or the desire for love or the desire, et cetera. I think there's also sort of the ability to, in some ways, address social issues or, the troubles of our times and that kind of thing. Star Trek is famous for doing that. But, like, you have, like, the X-Men trilogy of movies where mutantism is clearly a metaphor for LGBTQ issues, right? Where Bobby has to come out to his parents as a mutant, and how does his parents react to that? The question of if you could suddenly find a cure for mutantism, should, you know, should that, is there, isn't mutinism natural? Is there, should there be a cure? And does that imply that it's not, you know, all of those issues, mm-hmm. they play out in the X-Men movies, but they're clear sort of stand-ins for things that were being discussed at the, you know, mm-hmm. For real world issues, which in some ways is problematic in itself, but there is that. But then there is also, for example, trying to say, I'm going to write a story about a half-elf who feels like they are neither part of the human world nor the elf world, mm-hmm. And I feel that that is a good representation of an experience of a mulatto woman in the 1950s, and you will, that is not necessarily good in the sense of in my experience, what I've heard and what I have seen is that depending on the issue and depending on what you are trying to convey, the question comes up, well, why don't you just have a mulatto character who has to deal with that situation? Or some things taking too far out of context can in itself be sort of be offensive or be seen as sort of diluting the issue or trying to sidestep the issue. So there's a... I don't have all the answers, but there are, you have to kind of be aware of those things when you're considering how am I going to represent these issues.
But that would be like talking about Hermione Granger, you know, a muggle parents who has magic, who's not accepted in her world and isn't accepted at Hogwarts because she was muggle born. And I don't know that I would call that I don't know that that's representative of anything other than the story of Hermione and a lot of people who aren't accepted in their... Whatever they're, it's hard for me to take something and say I'd have to do it in a certain way.
Okay, here's a question. I'm going to assume that all of my readers are human, and that all of your readers are human, and that all of your readers are human. Would you do things differently if you knew that some of your readers were elves? Or vampires, or aliens,
yes.
Okay, why would that make things different? Because right now, I'm also assuming that everybody in the audience is human. if you are not, you know, raise your hand, or this will get really interesting. but you're writing for a human audience, and so by definition, all of elves and everything else are others, and you are trying to make those others be empathetic to your human audience.
No,
how would you do it differently if your audience really was made up of a true diversity of non-humans?
No, I think that's a really good point that you're making, and I think that that's, I don't know that I would personally change the stories. I think everyone sits down when they're doing anything, whether you're writing or taking a photograph, and we're all looking at things through a politically correct lens, and how are we going to say something and not offending the world and not making everybody get upset about anything. And in a weird way, I think that if a Fomorian was sitting out in the in our landscape, the, you know, giants in my world, who are blue and have really cool tattoos but tend to be overbearing and way too large to fit in most rooms, I could easily say something in the novel that would offend them, and you'd probably be censoring yourself a little bit more, but hopefully the character itself is what becomes unique and not what they look like.
So if I were writing about elves and there were really elves in the world, how I would do it differently is I would read stories and personal accounts from elves to understand their experience as best as I possibly could. I could never actually understand their experience, but as best as I could. And I would ask some elves to read what I had written to give me feedback on it and make sure that I hadn't, you know, hit these are the top 10 cliches that I hate when people write elves, or, you know, those kinds of things.
So would you already know elves, or would you have to go seek out elves to be your beta readers?
We could have an elf as a best friend.
Yeah, I have elves as friends.
I would hope that I would have elf friends, because that would be cool. But and if I did not, then I would have to go and seek out some elves. I would reach out, friends of friends, or without violating sort of their space as best I could, I would seek them out, and you know, I wouldn't tromp into the elven woods and be hey, but I would you know, there are probably groups online. There are probably groups by elves who seek to share their culture with the world and help other people, non-elves, understand the elvish culture. I would try to seek out them.
And start flame wars because of cultural appropriation from elves and vampires.
Yeah.
Because right. You are not one.
So then, you know, and of course I would happen to, all of the elves I got to read my thing would have to happen to have been high elves. And so they would. The wood elves would be like, you know, they may have signed off on that, but this is really offensive to wood elves. Hmm. So you have to be aware of all of that. There's no one person who represents an entire group. There's not even one group that represents an entire other. So, you know, it's, you can do the best that you can. All you can do is your due diligence. You have to want to try and get it right. You have to do as best you can to get it right. And then hope that you got it right.
So by writing speculative literature, we kind of get a free pass for cultural appropriation for imaginary beings, because we're assuming they're imaginary.
To the extent that the things that we make up wholesale or that are, bad pastiches of Lord of the Rings or something like that. But if you, frequently in fantasy, you borrow from real world cultures, consciously or unconsciously, and that's where you can sometimes still fall into that trap, especially if you're taking pieces of a culture without the larger context and just sort of pasting it on another culture. That's where you really run the danger of.
Yeah, it's really interesting because I write primarily using a lot of Celtic mythology, and there's not a whole, there's some written down. My experts are here today. who I bug every time I don't understand something, and I find like 20 different things that say different things about a particular god or goddess or hero in their culture. Primarily right now in Irish, and it's definitely very easy to feel like you're going to say the wrong thing, so you have to make sure that you're. But then it is fiction. And so you fictionalize it as best you can, and you come up with what works really well for the story, and hopefully it's more about the character than just the world you're living in, you know, like Percy Jackson, you know what I mean? The gods and goddesses kind of came into the story, but they weren't really the primary focus of it. They were just a layer of storytelling in there, of plot.
Game of Shadows is a fun read, I recommend.
Oh, thank you.
And Irish culture obviously is, Irish culture is, I'm part Irish, so it's Western, it is white. I think that, so in terms of sort of there are levels of, you know, they've been oppressed by the British, but
everybody's been oppressed by the British.
I'll just say that.
In England, the Irish are the other.
Yes, exactly.
And so are the Scots.
So it's all, again, it's all contextual. Other cultures that have been oppressed by the British,
Name one that hasn't.
I think there's only like 5 countries that haven't.
Yeah.
I'm just kidding. But it's interesting to what your point is that, you know, in a series I'm working on right now, also Tor, there's an African American character. Now, I come from Washington, D.C. I live in Los Angeles. My best friend is black. And I don't ever, I mean, writing in a voice, I don't hand them the manuscript and say, did I offend you in any way? Because if I did that every day, she wouldn't want to be my friend anyway. You know what I mean? And I'm not, there's no, they're just people like everyone else. So it's when you're, to me, when I'm, whether someone is, you know, we have lots of LGBT friends and lots of, you know, it's a very easy, my next door neighbor could be elf for all I know. I mean, this is LA, so, you know. So for me personally, I worry, I don't want to make those characters different in any, because I don't find them different in my real life, I guess is the way to say it. And so when you read the story, I'm hoping that nobody feels like this person is purple or orange or green or black or red or something else, because they're their own character and their own person.
We'll be taking questions up for the last like 20 minutes. Don't break your elbow.
Yeah, Ellen, I actually wanted to ask you. So I really love Wakulla Springs. If you haven't read it, it's a novella. You really should read it. It's beautifully written. You and Andy Duncan, right?
Yeah.
And it's set in sort of segregation era.
It's Tarzan the Creature from the Black Lagoon and Jim Crow laws in the Deep South.
Yeah.
Is the elevator speech.
Yeah. So kind of what was your process in terms of like researching or...
We did a lot. Andy Duncan is a really, really brilliant fantasy writer who is from South Carolina. And what we did was we talked about it for really long, like 7-8 years before we actually wrote something. And then we went, it's set in the panhandle of Florida in 1940 and 1953 and the present. And we went there. And we interviewed people, and we looked up the local history. Local history museums are great because they have stuff that doesn't make it into bigger books, or you find somebody that goes, oh, now my grandpa has a story about that. and we listened. And then we went to the Florida State Archives and read all of Zora Hurston's original WPA research about dialect and all of the stuff that was actually being, the oral histories that were being done in the 1940s, not there was no filter. And because we were both, all of the main characters in the book are African American, and I am not, and Andy is not. We talked about it for a long time before we started writing, about the fact that we could get ourselves in a mess of trouble. And then we wrote the most honest thing we could, and we did not get into a mess of trouble. Mm-hmm. Because we did not treat our characters as if they were separate from us. After having done a whole lot of research, we just did that weird Vulcan mind meld thing that you do with your characters where you are seeing the world from their point of view, not looking at them from the outside, but looking out from their eyes from the inside. Passing Strange is 6 gay women in 1940. And there is some stuff about the culture. What they were was illegal. You could actually be arrested. You could be jailed for kissing your girlfriend. And what I was trying to do was, again, it's told from their perspective, not the outside. So they're not weird. You're not weird in your own life. Mm-hmm. You know, whatever, even, you know, if you like to eat, I don't know, waffles with gravy, sorry, that was the weirdest thing I could come up with off the top of my head. This may not be what you serve to company, but you're not going to be sitting there eating it going, oh God, I shouldn't eat this. This is so weird. Because it's what you like. So for me, it's getting doing enough research to be able to get into the head of the character and in the case of historical fiction, into the time frame. And start looking at the world through the eyes of somebody who doesn't think that they're strange, who doesn't think that they're a pervert. They know that the rest, I mean, there's a dinner conversation where one of the women goes, you know, well, that seems awfully queer. And she says, well, yeah, it is tonight. And they're aware of the rest of society in the same way that the characters in Wakulla are aware of the rest of society. But they live their lives as if, you know, they know where the boundaries are. But if they're staying inside those boundaries, they're just living their lives and they don't actually give a shit. It's when they start coming near those boundaries and coming up against other people's assumptions of who they are that it gets dangerous, or it gets bad, or the reader starts to get uncomfortable. And I think that if you get into your character, whether it's a black woman in 1940 or an elf or somebody with magic powers or a dragon or an alien that doesn't even have what we would consider a body. If you can get your readers to forget that they're not one of them, if your readers start identifying with your characters, then you've done good work.
Excellent.
Yep.
Okay, and dead silence
dead
from
silence.
From
indeed.
Everybody.
Well said.
I mean, you're always writing about the other.
Yes.
Because unless you are writing about somebody that had exactly your experience, that lives
right.
on your block in LA
right.
and had your parents and went to your right. high school, you know, and you know, you can do that and you can get people to identify with it, but you're always writing somebody other than yourself.
Yes. Very true.
And so our work here is done.
Yeah.
Yes.
Now, in publishing, there are certain others when you're writing about that if you're not a part of their culture, they want you to be a part of the culture when you're writing about American Indian, Native Americans. That's definitely something where, you know, you want to be a part of the culture writing about that. So there are some areas in publishing where it's a little bit, when you're writing about those characters, you do, I mean, just from a business perspective, you do have to step on very lightly on how you're doing those things. And
I think you always have to tread lightly no matter what you're writing about. I mean, sometimes I write about five-year-olds and I am not a five-year-old. I was
you
one
were.
Once. It was a while ago. Or if you're in your 30s and you're writing a character who's in their 70s.
That's true.
You know, you are always writing about, you always have to be tread lightly. I mean,
yeah.
I think the line between writing a character who you did not share many characteristics with and cultural appropriation is a good and thoughtful writer, and it comes back to empathy. I used to do improv for like 20 years, and the one rule on stage is you are never mean to anyone on stage because you will turn off the audience. And I think that's equally true as an author. You can have characters that are mean to other characters, mm-hmm. but you have to signal to the reader somehow that you know that girl is mean, that you are not condoning this.
Yeah.
Because if you are mean to one of your characters mm-hmm. as an author, or mean to the reader, you're going to lose. You're going to, you know, they're going to put your book down and never pick it up again.
Yeah, that's very true.
So I think empathy is. I mean, I think empathy in real life is also everything. I think kindness is everything. Didn't we remember the book 10 things about life you should have learned in kindergarten? It actually, I mean, the book itself goes on and on and on and on, and it's very Mr. Rogers. But but those 10 things actually are really pretty good rules to live by and to write by. Never be mean to a character, you know, be kind, share, be thoughtful, be considerate. All of those things, as an author, you owe that to the reader.
Yeah, and then do you have the characters who aren't being those things that's the commentary on it. Right, so the characters who aren't being those things, the characters who are stepping over the line, pushing the buttons, are the examples of the things that, you know, especially when you're writing for YA, that you would hope that these are the things that you're commenting on that you don't want to be, you know.
And I think you need to signal the reader that you know that. There's a line in, Wakulla Springs was a collaboration with me and Andy Duncan. We each wrote part of it, and then we edited each other. And at this point, I don't think anybody other than us could tell who wrote what. But there was a scene where a black man is trying to get a reservation in a hotel, and it's a whites-only hotel. And he has just come back from the Korean War, and he's in uniform. And the man in the hotel is being awful. And all of the other guests are like, what does he think he is? He's an uppity N-word. And Andy put in a line that said, some people, some of the people in the lobby looked up to see the ugliness happen at the front desk. And I thought, yes, that's exactly, we need to tell the reader that we know this is wrong and that it's happening and that it was true and that it was real in the South. But you do need to signal the reader mm-hmm. that you know that this character is out of line. Because otherwise, you're going to get slapped down by somebody who's going, how could you possibly think? It's like, well, I don't, but I didn't. And
then the irony is in TV, a lot of times you're creating a character who's so completely awful that you just can't stop watching the train wreck. And so, yeah, there is that pause of everybody around the character going, what is this person? It's an alien. But a lot of times it's kind of interesting. You have to have that pause. You have to really like stop them from, you know, pushing it completely forward.
How do you deal with villains? Because so often in mediocre books, villains are one-dimensional. They're bad. And they are the one bad person. And how do you deal with villains?
I've increasingly... So for any of you who are writers out there, my caveat is so much of what we talk about comes out in revision. Like, so people think they need to have all of this figured out before they start writing. A lot of this gets worked out in revision. But so one of the things I've learned is the villain kind of drives a lot of the things, if it's a good villain, in the sense of, you know, it is because the villain has thrown the world into chaos that your hero has to go off on their adventure. Mm-hmm. And it is the villain's reaction to your hero attempting to stop your villain that drives your hero to make all the choices they make and take all the action. So your villain's kind of important. So in a lot of ways, I spend more time figuring out the villain sometimes than the hero. Because they are really the driver of a lot of things. And so, to that point, I need to understand what is the villain really want? Why are they doing what they're doing? And what is it they want? So that when the hero upsets their plans, I understand how the villain is going to react to that and how they're going to course correct and try to address it and what types of tactics are they going to use to try and change the situation again. And I think that in general, since we're talking specifically about fantasy, and creating fantasy creatures and creating empathy through them, you can slap pointy ears on a human and call them an elf. And they just have all of the characteristics of a human, but they're a little bit, you know, they like music and hanging out in the woods or whatever. but that's not really fantastical. So kind of the trick of it is to make them fantastical, make them interesting and different, and explore how they are different than humans without completely removing them so far that we no longer can relate to them and have that empathy. And so, you know, if I have large pointy ears, hearing is going to be much more important to me. And, maybe it's harder to keep secrets. So they've developed sign language when they want to talk without people overhearing them. And they may have music that goes into ranges that humans can't hear. So to humans, elf music sounds horrible. It doesn't sound beautiful because a lot of the notes they can't even hear. And so what they do hear doesn't make sense.
But dogs love it.
Dogs love it. And, you know, I mean, you start to think of all of these things and you can extrapolate and create something really interesting and unique in your fantasy creatures or your fantasy culture by asking fun questions like that. How would this really actually affect their culture, their behavior, who they are as a people? Or as a being. And but then you still, in the end, have to kind of come back to, I need to give my readers, though, things that they can connect with these beings. With the, you know, if it's a dragon or a lizard people, they're even more alien to us, right? But what about if they have jealousy, mm-hmm. Love, desires, things that we can relate to, then that creates the empathy. And you can still play out those human foibles and issues.
Yeah, for me, I like a villain to be sexy. I mean, just to be honest, I like someone who you're like, oh, it's too bad he's awful because I'd really like to go out on a date with him kind of a guy, if it's a guy. When I was trying to figure out what the villain in Game of Shadows was going to be. I kept imagining the evil side of Tony Stark, and still a ladies' man, still all these things. You might go out on a date with him, you'd end up dead, you'd be totally fine with that. So for me, it was like all these things in my head of like, okay, what would this character do? And he would have a lot of charisma. So he's not Voldemort, which he was creepy, and especially in the movies, was really unappealing. And so you're like, okay, who would this character be so that he could actually suck you into his world without you knowing how awful this person truly was, because deceit was a big part of his character. And so, especially as the series progresses. So for me, as I was doing exactly what you were talking about, and trying to break down, you know, the physicality of who he was, he didn't look all that different from my protagonist in terms of his physical being, except for a few tattoos and stuff. It was more internal and characteristics and yes, magic, but more dimensional, and how to break him out of the traditional mold of just being this person who's doing evil for evil's sake and wants to take over the world. He needed a bigger agenda, something more personal to themselves.
Bigger agenda than taking over the world?
Well, yeah. I mean, he still wants to take over Terra, but I think at the end of the day, there's always that reason, you know? I think it was Sherilyn Kenyon who said recently that, you know, you can't have revenge without having love, right? You can't have that idea that somebody, you're so in love with something that you're so upset that it's gone that you want revenge so badly, right? And so those same kinds of things apply to the villains. Something caused that villain to want to do this. They weren't babies aren't born evil, not at least not in my world. So what changed? What was their backstory? What changed them? So when I'm coming up with an idea for a villain, I usually sit down and write down all the external factors, the parents, the this, the that, the brother, do they have siblings, do they have this, where are they from? But then the internal side of things, how did they feel about themselves, what was there? Because usually there's always something in there that will pop out, you know, you know, I would like to say insecurity with Tony Stark, but I don't think that's a big problem for him.
I think we're also talking about villains as if they are the other, but everybody has not necessarily evil, but, you know, at least a proportion of good and bad in you. Mm-hmm. Okay, there may be a few exceptions out there of people who are perfect, but I have never met them. So you've also got the reader going, well, yeah, I would so totally do that. I mean, I wouldn't in real life. I would never actually kill my teacher for giving me a D, but you think it. And I think that that's one of the joys for the reader. If you've got a really good villain, is that they're identifying with the villain. Hannibal Lecter.
Yeah.
You are rooting for the serial killer. That is possibly the most brilliant villain I have ever read, because you really are rooting for the serial killer to win because everybody else is being an asshole. And I think that again, going back to that empathy, if you can identify with why the villain's doing something, it's like, yeah, okay, I've been that pissed off, you know. And I had more self-control, and I did not blow up Paris. But I could have. I mean, the villains aren't the other. The villains and heroes are just two sides of the same coin. They're not really opposites.
It also depends slightly on sort of what your purpose, what you're trying to give to your readers. Are you trying to give them escapism, or are you trying to give them, a story that perhaps has some lessons in it, or in some way holds a mirror up to nature or whatever, right? So, I mean, if you're just writing something that's pure escapism, you can have a villain that is just, you know, a Sauron or a, you know, the Dark Lord of the East, who is this sort of amorphous dark cloud of evil that sends his minions in, and, you know, and there are people who still, like, enjoy that type of fantasy, but I mean, there definitely has been a trend towards make your villain relatable, give them depth, give them complexity. Yeah. And I think that's tied to, in some ways, that we want something that's a little more intellectually and emotionally satisfying, in the sense of, you know, it's the difference between going and just watching a fun popcorn movie and watching something that you walk away, and, you know, it's a CGI fest versus something that is you walk away going, I'm going to buy that on DVD and watch it many times because I can get something different from it every time I watch it.
Yeah, it's very true.
Although sometimes they're the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes, yeah.
I mean, true. Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Good film.
Good popcorn movie, mm-hmm. and I've probably watched it 17 times.
Yeah.
Because not that I get a whole lot of serious intellectual depth out of it on the 15th watching, but you notice nuance.
You want a little hidden piece of trivia for Raiders of the Lost Ark? I was in the Lucas Archives, and you know the little beginning of the movie where there's the little statue that they're going after, right? There were two in the archives. Some of you know this story. I see people nodding. So apparently, one of them had the eyes painted all open on it, and one of them didn't. And if you go back and you watch the movie, there is a frame. They switched them out so that there is a frame in there with the actual eyes open. So there
just one frame?
Just a couple little frames. I mean, you'll see it. It will. Wow. They will pop up, and it looks like the statue opens its eyes. Anyway, so I had to go back and watch it again. But trivia.
Cool. Question?
I think, yeah, somebody had their hand up. Yes, you.
I had a question about...
do we have...
I wasn't sure how you were going to use the...
Hold on a second. Someone is going to bring you an actual microphone so everybody else in the room can hear you. That actual microphone.
Thanks. Yeah, it's working. Oh, okay. I'm wondering if you can speak to whether or not you've experienced creating empathy in yourselves through working with the characters that you're working with. You're talking about readers having empathy for characters, but I'm also wondering, as writers, your own experience, whether empathy grows in engagement with certain characters.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think you can get the readers to empathize if you haven't already internalized it. You know, there's that old saw, you know, write what you know, and as we've just discussed, that doesn't mean writing exactly who you are. It means writing from your gut. It means writing from your experience. I remember writing a scene where a character gets really angry, and I spent 3 days pissing myself off, and remembering when I was angry, and taking notes about the physicality of it. It's very weird to get really angry and take notes at the same time.
And because your family doesn't want to be around you.
Well, my cat didn't want to be around me. And I ripped through. I mean, I was writing so hard, I ripped through pieces of paper with the pen. But it's that internalizing it that makes it, you know, you have to figure out how to describe that on the page. So, yeah, I think that you have to empathize with your characters. I actually think you have to completely identify and absorb and be part of your characters in order to be able to do, not all of them, you know, this, but yeah.
And sometimes I think it's your protagonist going through the difference between sympathy and empathy. So, I mean, quite frankly, it's easy to write a character who's sympathetic towards another character situation, but then when you take that protagonist or character, whoever you're writing from that POV, and you drag them into a situation where they're forced to realize almost that they didn't really understand what this other world was. I think there's kind of when you can get there, and I'm not saying I'm the most successful writer in the world at doing that, because it takes a really powerful thing, but to really get into the difference of those two words and really dragging someone down into being completely empathetic.
Somebody once said, you know, you can do all the research you want, but you cannot Google the first time you felt betrayed.
Mm-mm. Yeah, I think I pass as human now, so
okay.
That is good.
Man in the shirt that says store, I cannot read the rest of it. Excelsior. It does not say store. It says Eeyore. Not Eeyore, but, you know.
Thanks. Oh. You're talking a lot about characters and how to identify with them and get into them. What have you had a character take over and get out of your control? And what happened to the story, or, you know, how'd you react to that?
You want to go?
Sure. So, you know, writers, every story is different. Every writer is different. And most people come either character driven, you know, and they start with a character or an idea and it sort of grows organically, or there are people who are very plot driven. But I think that, you know, and they figure everything out ahead of time and then write the story. But I think in either way, whichever approach, or if you're somewhere in the middle, eventually the characters inevitably take over to some degree, if they're good characters, if you've done your job. And in part, and then again, that's why I say, you know, a lot of being a writer comes in the revision process, because you can start off with an idea of who your character is and what your story is going to be, but until you've written the end, anything could happen. You know, minor characters can be major characters. There's a couple of characters who don't really do a lot, so they end up kind of being merged into a single character, you know, and your characters will go off on tangents. And it's a whole topic in and of itself to talk about that, but generally speaking, you know, yes. And when they do, you know, you either go along for the ride, or you kind of have to step back and say, oh, is that really where I want this story to go? And then you have to kind of go back and rein them back in. And
then sometimes the opposite happens, where I remember in the edit phase for Game of Shadows, there was a character in there. And I was asked by Tor, this book was originally written for a younger audience than it is now, and they wanted to do it as a YA crossover, so I was aging it up, and as I was doing that, it went through a probably 6-month long editorial process just on the draft that it was on. And in doing so, Christian had a little sister. And as I was writing through, every time I kept trying to put her in, I'm like, well, she's kind of young to be in this scene, and it's kind of awkward. So finally, I emailed my editor, and I'm like, I think I don't know what to do about Edmé, because I can't seem to fit her in the right way. She sends me back a gif that's basically like Dorothy and the Wizard of Oz kicking Toto out the door. Like, it was so sad. She's like, cut him out. So you lose those characters, and they die quickly, and it's like they never sadly ever existed. So for me, sometimes the opposite happens, because I end up always creating more characters than I probably need, because your head is existing in that world, and you want to fill it and populate it with all kinds of people. But at the end of the day, you also can't have so many characters that your readers can't remember who anybody is. So
I also think that, you know, if your characters start going in a direction that you didn't expect, you should probably follow them.
Yeah.
Because if you're trying to squeeze them into the story that you think they should be in, and they're going, not my story, really, not my story, you should probably listen. Or, you know, unless you've got a very, very tightly plotted, you know, like murder mystery or something, and you're going, well, no, you're in a different book now.
Yeah, exactly.
So I will write that book later, but you know, and you save those scenes,
yeah.
But yeah, sometimes, you know, kill your darlings.
Sad.
Somebody else had a...
Thank you. Directing this question to you, Randy, since we're talking about writing outside of the adage, write what you know, and you presumably have not encountered wizards and Sasquatch, what resources do you typically turn to make your fantasy creatures seem believable?
We can all answer that, obviously. But for me, Google. And Amazon.com or independent, you know, book, your local independent bookstore can I just do the research. But mostly, to be honest, so the Fin Fantasy series is a little bit different in that I wrote it to have fun as a writer, and hopefully, you know, that would come through to the readers. So I threw in what seemed fun to me. In that scene. So it was kind of a scene by scene, situation by situation. What would be like, you know, I didn't want to have vampires and werewolves and stuff. So what would be fun and different to throw into this scene? And so that's why there's Sasquatches and gnome mobsters and stuff like that. And once I made that decision, I'm like, oh, I can imagine, I can picture this. I sort of made them up, and then in the revision process went back and sort of did some research. I didn't want to be do what everyone else had done. All right. So it's sort of like the more you research, or the more you base it on things that you've read from others, then the more it's going to likely be the same as everyone else who does that same research. So depending on, I mean, if you are depicting something that has cultural relevance to a living culture, you know, you don't want to have Gerard Butler be an Egyptian god, for example. you do want to, you know, so in those cases, you want to do your due diligence, do your research, and try to depict it as faithfully as possible, and in the correct context. But if you are just, you know, throwing something that's completely fantastical in and isn't part of, say, a living religion, or would have, you know, cultural appropriation mm-hmm. overtones and those kinds yeah. of things, then just have fun with it, I say. And, you know, vampires have been reimagined in every shape, form, and power yeah. and weakness. And
well, you're really good at not falling. There's a word that I really hate that a lot of people use, which is the word trope. And I mean, there's everything is a trope right now. I mean, there's nothing that's been untouched in fantasy. Vampires, werewolves, you know, anything you name. You know, I had brownies in my book, and somebody commented on that being a trope. I'm like, I haven't read any other books with brownies in them, but maybe there are a lot of brownies out there. So it's hard to reinvent. You know, you're not... There's always going to be that thing that's going to feel like it, you know, you're doing another werewolf story. But what's different about your werewolves? What's different about the thing that you're creating? And it runs in cycles, right? You know,
I'd say two things. One of them is I go back to what I read as a kid, and why I read it, why I liked Edward Eger's Half Magic more than just about any other book, why I loved Mrs. Pigglewiggle. Yay, Mrs. Pigglewiggle. And just to get that sense of wonder again, because I think that's the key for me to writing anything fantastic is that sense of wonder. Yep. And my other favorite resource is eBay, because I'm a very tactile writer. And so if I'm writing in a particular, I write a lot of things that are set in the late 20th, or the mid 20th century. So if I can actually have an object from that time period mm-hmm. and I can hold it, there is yeah. like any magic object in a fantasy book, there is a power to that of saying, somebody actually, like, when this was new, you could have walked into a dime store and bought this. And what does that say about when you walk out of the dime store? What's the world like? What's everything like? And there is something really magical for me about being able to pick up mm-hmm. something and go, okay, what if this is the glass of power? and because I write stuff in the past, I'm always shopping for stuff on eBay, or just, you know, 2 a.m. and you're a little stoned and you're typing in monkey puppets the way you do, and you stumble over something that you would never in a billion years imagine, and you go, yeah. Okay, I don't necessarily have to buy it, but I'll download the graphics, and I have this file yeah. of just like weird images that I can use to spark something off.
Yeah.
So
music and images are all, yeah, very helpful when you're doing these things. Like, especially if you're writing from a perspective yeah. that is not your own.
Yeah.
If you're writing a character who is very, you know, other or fantastical, you're, you know, when it's inevitable that when you write and you start to write the protagonist and you're writing and the protagonist is in some ways, it's hard to separate it from being you, right? It's
because
no matter how different the protagonist is, you still, your default brain wants to be envision the protagonist as yourself.
Yeah, and they almost always end up making popcorn
yeah.
at some point.
yeah, yeah. And so having oh, this is a picture of who my protagonist is, and listening to music that is, you know, in tune yeah. with who my protagonist is, and stuff like that helps yeah. me to like sort of.
So for
get
me,
my brain
people
in
always
mode.
Ask that question about yeah. do you write to when you're do you listen to music when you're writing? And so I can't actually listen to music when I'm writing. I listen to music when I'm building a setting. So if I'm in New Orleans, I'll turn on the soundtrack to The Big Easy, and I'll hear the words and hear the Cajun accents in my head and be able to feel New Orleans. I had a pilot script that I was working on recently, and it was all had to be set in that French Quarter feel. And I can listen to it, but then when I start writing the dialogue, I have to turn the music off because I can't.
Yeah, I can't listen to music. I can sometimes listen to instrumental music if I'm writing, mm-hmm. but it's almost always because I'm writing in a time period and I need music from that time period. And, you know, because of the internet, you can find anything from anywhere, anytime. You know, 3 a.m, you go, well, I wonder what the top 40 hit was in April of 1943.
Yep.
And one push of the button, and you can hear it. And it's like, wow, yeah. Living in the future, so cool.
I wanted to touch again on just what you were saying about, you know, you're writing for fun. I said I was writing for fun. I think that's really, really crucial. Like, people will sometimes write what they think, you know, what they think is going to sell
yeah.
or what is trendy or what, you know, or yeah. check themselves. They'll start to write something and go, no, there's too many of that. Or, mm-hmm. or no one wants to read, you know, or whatever, a unicorn story, book,
yeah.
you know, the last unicorn, everyone will just say, I'm copying the last unicorn. I don't want to do that.
Right.
But if that's your first impulse, you know, if you love unicorns, if you have unicorn throw pillows and unicorn, you know, everything, write a unicorn book, man. Yeah, that's what I say. Have fun with it. Go to your passion, because that will come through in mm-hmm. the writing, and the readers will pick up on that, and it's more likely to. You will not get to the middle. You know, you will inevitably, when you get to the middle of the book, go, oh, I'm the worst writer ever, and this is the dumbest story ever. And,
that happens to everybody.
Yeah, but if it's you're writing something that you are truly enjoy and are passionate about, you're more likely to get past that point and actually finish the book than if not.
Jason, and I think you're yeah. also probably going to go in a different direction, because if you're really passionate. I mean, I write some kids' books, and so I tell kids being a writer is the coolest job in the world, because you get to find something that you're curious about and actually go find out about it, and it's work. Mm-hmm. Except it isn't, but. You know, it's like I actually get paid for playing around on Google. And you follow your own curiosity, and you yeah. find stuff that you never would have thought about, and go, oh, that just made the second half of the book work, mm-hmm. because, you know, I found out about this weird thing that I never would have looked for because I didn't know it existed.
Yeah, it never works to chase yeah. trends, because
yeah.
by the time you get there, it's already gone. So.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay, thank you. My question is, what do you recommend in terms of how to develop empathy for a fictional character, either a fantasy character or a human character who is other? Is it really thinking about their experience? Ellen, I noticed you mentioned a character who was angry and thinking of all of the times you were angry to get yourself in that headspace, but would you recommend comparing it to your own experience and thinking deeply about your own experiences, or just really trying to understand what the character's experiences are and getting, you know, more deeply into them and not, you know, maybe they don't have much in common. Maybe you've never had an experience similar to theirs, or maybe you don't want to assume that your experience, that their experience is like yours. Just what do you recommend there?
Both. I think you have to write a character from your inside out, and then from their outside in.
You, generally speaking, a character walks into a scene, they want or need something, they're thwarted in some way, they react in some way. Mm-hmm. So you just kind of take it from that approach and try and ask yourself, just put yourself, say, okay, I know how I would react, but if I were this character who had this background and this experience and these abilities and this whatever, And I walk into the scene, what is it that I want? What is it that I need? And then when, I'm thwarted, how would I react? How would I feel about that? And would I get angry? Would I pull into myself? Would I start to doubt myself? Or would I like go on a rampage? So I think you just have to kind of do that. Just sort of place yourself scene by scene, moment by moment, just sort of ask yourself, what would this character do in this moment?
Yeah. If I'm understanding your question too, I think by using a simple example of Harry Potter, a kid who's, you instantly feel sorry for, he's living under the stairs, his parents have been killed by an evil menace. That's you're instantly sympathetic and empathetic if you've ever lost a parent. When you're creating the character per se, but when you're creating the arc of taking this character and making them sympathetic or empathetic to someone else, it doesn't happen in a scene. It has to happen as the character grows through the story, right? So it would be multiple scenes and different things. If you had a character who's being introduced into a world that makes them very uncomfortable, what would then make them comfortable in the world? Befriending one of them, how do their oddities fit in well and they suddenly get to know each other just like a regular friendship or human would, right? At least if I understand correctly.
Yeah, and
I
like that you mentioned sympathy versus empathy. So sympathy we feel right off for characters, yeah. If you've done your job, where that poor Harry Potter living underneath the stairs. Okay. But we don't really know. I mean, we understand his situation. We have sympathy for his situation, but we don't know who Harry Potter is yet. Mm-hmm. We haven't, and so we build empathy for Harry Potter through walking in his shoes and experiencing things and understanding how he reacts. Mm-hmm. And we become, in a way, we are experiencing it as Harry Potter. That's the whole point, yeah. Right? To a degree. And therefore we are empathetic. We feel what he feels. We want what he wants. Mm-hmm. We fear what he fears.
He becomes empathetic to the house elves, to the elves that are, is that what they were called? Like Dobby, right?
Yeah.
And through experiences, right? This character was friggin' driving him nuts, and torturing him all the way through that book. But in the end, he was a slave. He was owned by this other family and couldn't leave without getting this thing. And so in the end, I'm trying to remember movie versus book because they're both in my head right now. When he gets the sock or gets this piece of clothing, you instantaneously realize that not only has Harry grown sympathy, which he had in the beginning for this character, but now it's empathy in the sense that, and we're empathetic to the plight and want to do something about them.
Yeah, I think you map human emotions onto your non-human characters. Mm-hmm. And it would be a very interesting panel, although not this one because we only have time for one more question, to discuss whether or not alien emotions are different than human emotions. Because almost all of the books that I've ever read were, I assume, written by human authors. And again, our readers are human, so mapping human emotions onto an alien is how you make that connection with the reader. You'd have to be really, really good to make up alien emotions. Really, really good. We have time for one more question. Okay, we have two hands up, so we'll take both of them. There's one there and one all the way in the back. And she will meet you halfway. And the other people will try take that moment to escape.
Great.
Bye.
I am dragging us back to something that someone said earlier about the Irish, while they're Western and they're white. And we all just kind of nodded at that, forgetting that, in fact, they've become white. But when they first tried to come to America, they were considered, non-white and this existential menace because they were Catholic and it was, a Protestant nation and so on. So I'm wondering if you can think of any characters, not specifically, you don't have to deal with the Irish, but like a literary character that might have helped change that, de-other somebody, if you can twist the language that way. Do you know what I'm saying? I mean, it probably wasn't Scarlett O'Hara.
Someone who might have changed the way we look at a particular
group
like of people.
Probably again, it wasn't Scarlett O'Hara, but somebody who could have changed America's view on a group so that they're no longer, so they could empathize with the Irish and see them as, you know, white like us. Do you know what I'm saying?
Kind of.
Okay. I think it's more. I'm not sure that there's literature that changes the view of that other group as much as there's always another group behind them pushing them into the mainstream.
Mm-hmm.
So that after, I mean, I remember my parents, I'm as WASP as anybody in the world, and my mother said, well, you know, you have ancestors from Wales and England and Scotland. And I said, well, if I got them from Wales and England and Scotland, you know, there must be some from Ireland. And she said, there is no Irish in our family. and I was about seven, and I thought, what? And because I did not know that at any point being Irish had been a lower down position, because by the time I was a kid, mm-hmm. there had been three or four waves of immigration since the Irish, and the Irish were just part of us.
And then you had the Kennedys, so.
Yeah.
I mean, I think, you know, like you look at, well, you watch the movie Brooklyn popped in my head when you were talking about a small story about I actually went to Enniscorthy by accident on my last trip to Ireland. We were lost. We were driving. We pulled into this town, and everybody kept talking, well, this is the town that was in the movie Brooklyn, and I sadly had not seen that movie, so I was really mortified. But as we're walking around the town, you could tell, it was the story as small. It was the same story you would have had here in the States if you were from a really small town in West Virginia and you were moving to New York City. You know, this girl was from a small, really tiny town in Ireland and moves to New York, and they all lived in their own little group. So by being placed in her mindset and with these other girls that were all here and trying to marry, and she ends up with an Italian, ooh, you know, scandalous. So in those days, you know, now we'd look at it and you could say it's all a white world, you know, in that way, but it was very different back then, and I think it's, I don't know that, I guess, literature can change that, but it also has to do with all of us changing that,
I think, there are obviously several books I can think of, like, that for the African-American experience, Roots and mm-hmm. Beloved and, To Kill a Mockingbird and other things that I'm sure has helped.
Their Eyes Were Watching God, 1927.
Eyes Were Watching God. But mm-hmm. to obviously, you know... I would not say we're anywhere close to having.
But it's us that
empathy.
Have to make that.
There is always an other.
Yeah.
I mean,
other,
I grew up in Ohio.
Yeah.
We considered people in West Virginia. You know, when you're telling ethnic jokes, there's always a one down ethnic, no matter where you are. If you're in Montana, it's people from South Dakota. So there's always going to be an other, it's just that there's, you know, bigger cultural others than not. We had one more question, and it has to be a fairly quick one because we've got like 1 minute.
Have any of you ever written like an Igor style villain instead of like a villain who's not really seductive at all? There's nothing really that appealing about them.
An Igor, is that what you're saying?
Like a hench.
Yeah. Master, yeah. I have brought the monster.
Yes, master.
Yeah.
I've read a lot of books that I've loved that actually make them the protagonist. You know, Homeland, Ari Salvatore, Dark Al Dritzt, that character. You know, those characters aren't the most attractive in the world yet. You know what I mean? But I don't know, I always feel like making an even evil villain look all hunchback with warts all over their face is sort of like, well, I feel like that's kind of racist. There's something wrong with that. They shouldn't have to be that, you know.
Yeah,
I don't know.
There's a story in my new collection called The Education of a Witch. It's about a kid who goes to see Sleeping Beauty and just falls madly in love with Maleficent. Because the princess is really boring, and Maleficent has her own castle and can turn into a dragon and wears purple and is so cool, and all of the adults are going, no, honey, no, that's the witch. And it's like, yes, the witch.
In my Fin Fancy books, the villains tend to not be attractive, but some, a couple of them think they are. You know, they try to like they think they're better than they are, kind of, or they're cooler than they are, I guess. They have a certain amount of ego and hubris. And,
but your villains can be anything you want them to be.
Yeah. So. Thank you all. Thank you, Randy. Sorry.
Erica.
Thank you, Erica. I was just going to call you Lewis.
That's okay.
Because then, and that would have been confusing. We are going to be signing in the interior courtyard. I have no idea what that means. Out this door?
Yep, right.
Okay, out this door. Books are going to be sold by the lovely Books, Inc. Thank you all for coming, and enjoy the rest of your afternoon.
Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the 2017 Bay Area Book Festival. For more podcasts, please go to www.baybookfest.org.